Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, and second, Adam Kotsko, will examine the theology of neoliberalism. And at the bottom of the hour, Kristen Godsey will explore how capitalism messes with our emotional lives and how socialism can make it all better. Neoliberalism. Yes, it sometimes sounds like it's devolved into a cliché or a term of abuse, but it actually means something. In a condensed definition, I'd say it was the attempt, beginning in the 1970s and accelerating in the 1980s, to undo the post-World War II welfare state, never all that strong in the U.S. for sure, and with it dismantle all ideas of collective action, turning us into competitive and self-sufficient machines, governed by money. Yes, these tendencies were always present in capitalism, but the neo part emphasizes that this is the product of conscious political action. In his book, Neoliberalism's Demons on the Political Theology of Late Capital, published in September by Stanford University Press, Adam Kotsko gets to the heart of the neoliberal worldview. Kotsko is on the faculty of the Scheimer Great Book School at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. He's a busy man. This is, I believe, his eighth book. Adam Kotsko. A lot of analysis of neoliberalism talks about clawing back the state, getting the state out of the way of the market, letting the market flourish in its full beauty and potential. You regard this as a bogus opposition, this state versus market, right?
Yes, I do. I think that a lot of people expect neoliberalism to basically just be libertarianism of the kind that you like read about on Reddit or something. And I think it's very clear if you go back and read the sources that the neoliberal theorists themselves were very sure that the state needed to play a crucial role in creating and sustaining markets, and that they needed to be very intentional about that.
Well, as Margaret Thatcher famously said, the economics was the tool, but the idea was to remake the soul. So we're really even like getting down to the level of the personality itself that needed to be transformed.
Right. Yes, it is. It's kind of an irony because neoliberalism poses itself as kind of an opponent to totalitarian projects when it does have a similarly totalitarian ambition of kind of reshaping all of us kind of all the way down to be pure market participants.
Well, and Foucault writes some about that, drawing on Gary Becker. I mean, the idea is to turn us all into little, I mean, this is always present in the idea of Hobo Economicus, but it seems like an intensification of the concept, to turn us all into little, like, small businesses, personal calculating machines with not skills so much as, you know, building our human capital and all that. It's really, like, bringing that level of the market down to the personality.
Yeah, it's really shocking when you take a step back and think about how impoverished this view of the human person is, and yet at the same time how much success it has had. I'm told that when Gary Becker first coined the term human capital, you know, Gary Becker is kind of famous for amoral thought experiments, and so he probably like viewed this as one of them. But people were shocked by the term. They thought it was offensive. Now we use it commonly in everyday life.
Neoliberalism is a funny term in that it's kind of like the masses. Nobody ever identifies as a member of the masses. People really generally shy away from being labeled as neoliberals. And a lot of people who are, I would say, you know, objectively, if you want to sound a little Stalinist about it, objectively neoliberals, reject the label and say it's just an epithet and a slur. What do you make of that?
Anybody who kind of represents the hegemonic or dominant position doesn't want to be labeled, you know. White people will ask, you know, can't we just be people? Like, why do you have to bring race into it or something like that? And while it's not exactly a parallel situation, neoliberals do view their ideology as kind of just the way things are, as the way things are and should be, and therefore it doesn't make sense to them to have a special label for it.
But, you know, as Murawski demonstrates, and others as well, the imposition of the neoliberal order on the world over the last several decades is a project you can attach names to, right? I mean, this is not something that just spontaneously happened, although a lot of these folks would like to think of the market as some kind of state of nature.
Right. It's very clear. I think that Melinda Cooper's book, Family Values, is especially helpful for this because she narrates the history of the political struggle that happened as the Fordist kind of social democratic order was breaking down, and it was not obvious that neoliberal solutions were what needed to happen. That there was a concerted kind of propaganda and activist effort, and they were very successful in it.
You mentioned Belinda Cooper, and you draw on a lot of her work in your book. One of the interesting parts that you discuss is the relationship between neoliberalism and family values. I mean, people sometimes see an opposition between the Clinton-style neoliberalism, which is more, you know, laissez-faire in the realm of personal morality, not necessarily in fact, but at least partly in rhetoric or appearance, and the more punitive family values of the Christian right. But these two are complementary or move in parallel, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, in Thatcher's famous quote, where she said there's no such thing as society, her follow-up is that there are only individuals and families. Neoliberals realize that we aren't just like individual monads who spring out of the ground, that we do need some minimal social formation and support. Some of them were motivated by the sincere belief that the family could more efficiently provide for those kind of goods of social reproduction and that it was necessary to nudge people towards the family. You can see it in some of Gary Becker's work where he seems very worried that Social Security is going to break down family connections because parents won't need their kids to care for them and things like this. So I do think that while neoliberalism is often viewed as like kind of a corrosive force that's undoing the family, and maybe objectively that's happening, what they thought they were doing was trying to strengthen the family and traditional sources of authority over against the state, which they viewed as breaking it down.
The welfare reform bill that Clinton signed, there's a long preamble that is all about family values, and what they're trying to do by eliminating welfare is to restore the family primacy. At first glance, that looks like a lot of propagandistic nonsense, but there's a deep truth to what they're getting after by trying to reestablish some notion of a traditional family, whether it actually existed or not.
Right. I mean, we've all read or at least scanned over dozens of articles about the millennials and their strange habits and their desire to stay home and helicopter parenting and stuff like that. And like, how did this happen? Well, this is the generation that came up under neoliberalism. And if the goal was to make children more dependent on their parents, it completely worked.
You use this in the subtitle of your book, and you talk about it at some length. You're using a kind of theology, a theological approach to studying neoliberalism. To a secular like me, I always have to stumble a bit over the word theology. What do you mean by theology? What power does it give you as a mode of analysis?
Yeah, I use theology in kind of a broader, more analytical sense, not in terms of that I'm trying to analyze neoliberalism from the standpoint of some particular like doctrinal stance or something like that. You know, I am not a Christian, but I want to see what kind of theology neoliberalism implies. And I use theology broadly to mean, you know, what are the values that it's trying to get at? What are its ultimate goals? What does it see as a vision of human flourishing? It's trying to see what neoliberalism's theology is rather than to kind of like impose some pre-existing theology on neoliberalism.
And what does it offer? What is it? What is its vision of the good life? It promises freedom, for example, right?
Yeah, freedom is its absolute value. I mean, freedom in a very specific sense of being free to participate and compete in the market. And I talk about how this, the structure of freedom actually, for the most part, functions to set people up to take the blame for things, that we're given just enough freedom that we can mess up, but not enough freedom to actually make a substantial difference in the world.
The Christian angle of that is interesting, that, you know, God set up Satan for a fall, right? With all this bit about anybody who's like, ever thought about Christianity wonders, you know, why did God create evil? Why did he make the possibility of damnation? How does it serve his ends? Yeah, what about that setting us up for a fall? How are we all like Satan in the neoliberal world?
This is kind of a deep cut in Christian theology, the notion of like how God set up Satan for a fall. But I think a common sense like interpretation of the story of Adam and Eve, I think anybody reading that story naively thinks, why did God give them that weird command in the first place? Why did he even put the tree there? Like, you know, he gave them the idea to eat the fruit. Maybe it would never occur to them before. And these kind of scenarios are frequent in theology. And the way that theologians came to understand this is that actually evil is necessary for God's glory, that God actually gets more glory and more kind of prestige or honor if he's able to draw good out of evil than if he just did straight up good. Something similar is going on with the neoliberal order. If people are kind of entrapped into a situation where, for instance, crime is the only option and they freely choose to commit crime, then that gives the government options for how to gain glory from that. They can either gain glory through punishing them, they can gain glory through appearing merciful and helping them to redeem themselves or something like that. They generate a certain amount of evil or undesirable behavior so that they can pose as either the punisher or the savior.
The two wings of the neos, I guess we could call them, that prevail in politics. Neoliberals in the form of the Clinton tradition, and neoconservatives, especially the younger Bush, and even the Tea Party and all these much more punitive Christian Republicans. They're in opposition in a way, but they're also working in concert. There's this pattern of redemption on one hand and punishment on the other, right?
Right, yeah. And I think that's why these two apparently opposed forces work together in concert so much, is because they're working off the same deep presuppositions. The neoconservatives at the end of the day are willing to let people redeem themselves, even though they have like much more punitive standards for it, just as the Clinton neoliberal wing is willing to let people, you know, suffer the consequences of their actions. It's really a kind of polarity of preference and emphasis rather than a radically different worldview.
Murawski, to bring him up again, talked in his book about neoliberalism, Never Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste, right? He talked about the centrality of a punitiveness or humiliation to the neoliberal model of politics. I mean, how does that fit into the way you're seeing things?
You know, looking back, we can see, you know, it's often associated with the more conservative wing. Like the fact that, you know, Reagan's press secretary was like making homophobic jokes when he was asked about the AIDS epidemic and things like this, you know, like incredibly cruel behavior of the kind that we're seeing again now. But I think you can see some of that cruelty and some of that patronizingness in the Clintons as well, you know, like their willingness to sign the crime bill, Hillary, you know, using the slur of super predators, or calling significant portions of the country deplorable. Sometimes I wonder, with the election occurring under such questionable circumstances, and it's clearly a technicality, and yet everything orchestrated to move to like, well, Trump won, it's over, you know, let's just do this without any serious exploration of other options. And I wonder if it's like the Clinton-Obama wing saying, well, the people chose wrong, let's let them get their medicine now, maybe they'll learn.
Yeah, let the deplorables marinate in their own mess.
Yes, absolutely.
I'll speak with Adam Kotsko, author of Neoliberalism's Demons. This is especially true of Brexit, that you can maybe not quite as applicable to Trump, but with Brexit, there's no vision of what people expected when they triumphed. I mean, aside from some nostalgic idea of going back to a little England of misty past, there is, it seems, no coherent, ideologically, emotionally, psychologically coherent alternative to neoliberals and all neoliberals at this point. All people can do is make these reckless gestures of defiance that really point nowhere and do actually end up causing destructiveness rather than any kind of redemption. Are we just lacking in any kind of imagination of how to get out of this?
The neoliberal order, it would prefer to have a situation like Bush versus Gore, where you could initially believe that the two are fundamentally the same, and it's just, you know, Coke versus Pepsi. I mean, I think we know in retrospect that that wasn't really the case, but that was how it was presented. But it seems like if that's not on offer, the next best thing is kind of to demonstrate the thesis that there's no alternative by putting up a plausible candidate and then an implausible candidate. Like, to have an election where the premise is that the election should not be taking place at all, that there shouldn't even be a choice. And yes, the fact that these dummy options sometimes win is a flaw in the system, but perhaps one that they view as like chastening. What's interesting, though, is they will absolutely redouble their efforts to make sure that an actual left-wing alternative never reaches the level of plausibility. There was a much more concerted effort to make sure that Bernie Sanders didn't get the nomination than there was to make sure that people in Michigan didn't inexplicably vote for Trump or something like that.
Speaking of Trump, the vexing figure of Trump, how does he fit into your analysis? Where did he come from? You know, in some ways, he looks like a departure from neoliberalism in that, you know, he talks against free trade. He's really like fixated on the border. wasn't all that long ago, we were talking about a borderless world in which capital and people could flow freely across space. How did he come out of this system? Where did he emerge from?
I view him as almost a parody of neoliberalism, because even though he deviates from best practices of neoliberalism on trade and things like that, he definitely views all of life as a zero-sum competition. I don't think that that's a controversial characterization. It seems to be what people like about him. He seems to me to fundamentally believe in the neoliberal premise that everything should be a competition and the best people should win. But since who he regards as the best people are not winning, he concludes, oh, the system must be rigged. There must be cheating going on, and I need to counteract that. So I think that his conspiracy thinking actually grows directly out of his neoliberal presuppositions and also his refusal to view himself as a loser.
But what about his crudeness, his misogyny, his racism, his xenophobia? Are those always like present in the neoliberal model in a more sotto voce way, or is this an innovation?
That's where Melinda Cooper is so valuable in showing that all of those types of, like, that neoliberalism wasn't just an abstract thought experiment of, like, what if we let the market rule everything? That the way that they wanted to reshape society was to make sure that traditional hierarchies of privilege and prestige could continue in a way that seemed legitimate because it seemed as though everybody had freely chosen it.
And so when we're talking family values, we mean a certain kind of family, a patriarchal family with a white patriarch.
Yes, it's still controversial whether blacks should be allowed to have the same type of families as whites, although it's clearly the case that they're demonized and scapegoated for inexplicably failing to do so. People who worry about that obviously don't see that they're kind of being entrapped into not being able to form those families. I think the gay marriage issue is really interesting because it shows that there is room to kind of expand the model as long as it looks as much as possible like the heterosexual patriarchal family, monogamous couple, legally married, this kind of thing. And even the fact that the first lawsuit that led to the Supreme Court ruling was based on, like, it was a very wealthy couple and based on a question of inheritance. I think that fits perfectly into the neoliberal model. Not to say that gay marriage is not a good thing or a beneficial thing for people, but it does. I think there's a reason that it was one of the social advances that was possible under neoliberalism.
Yeah, it does take us back to Engels on the origin of the bourgeois family in having to manage inheritance.
Yes. Yeah, and as a working class person raised in kind of a paycheck to paycheck family, like the idea that people are thinking about inheritance at all is so bizarre to me, but apparently that's how neoliberals think.
Getting back to Trump and in demonization, you emphasize very strongly the importance of demonization in this neoliberal paradigm. Trump, like, lives on his demons. And now, you know, we saw these pictures we've seen over the last several days of desperate migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border being tear gassed, children running away from the toxic fumes. What do we make of that? What pleasure is being gotten from these scenes of torture? What satisfactions are being derived?
Yeah, it seems like the drive to competition, the drive to win, I think that there is intrinsically a drive to humiliation in that as well. You can't be a winner without losers. You can't be superior without somebody subjecting themselves to you. And I think that Trump's entire worldview is clearly based on his ability to victimize and subordinate everybody who comes across his path. While I don't want to venture into too much armchair psychoanalysis, I sometimes wonder if the idea of victimizing children or especially innocent people is actually directly appealing to him because it's more outrageous and more over the top and more difficult for people to accept.
There's something reminiscent of the demonization of the welfare mother. As you pointed out, she was at once irresponsibly rich, you know, with her Cadillac derived from public funds. At the same time, she was poor and parasitical. And now here we have these migrants who are just desperate with nothing but the clothes on their backs, who are somehow seen as threatening the entire social order of the United States. I mean, how do we reconcile these twin images of debasement and power?
It's really hard to think about. It's hard to really ponder what's going on with all of this demonization and victimization of people. I mean, on one hand, it's almost if it wasn't so cruel and destructive, it would be comical. Like the idea that they need to send the army to the border to defend us from like poor people with nothing but the clothes on their backs. And I think that there is a glimmer of hope because I've written about the fact that my parents, for example, are evangelical Christians and they are Trump supporters. But these issues are the one thing where they start to say, whoa, what did I sign myself up for? And there's also the fact that this kind of imagery, like this demonization of the caravan and stuff like that was kind of an electoral ploy, but it failed, that people kind of were not buying it. And I wonder if we could be reaching a saturation point where people realize like this is just senseless cruelty and there's actually no benefit to it. There's no, he's not defending us from anything. Not that I want to think of instrumentalizing these poor people for our own domestic benefit or anything like that, but I just wonder how far can it really go?
After the financial crisis, it's been 10 years now, neoliberalism seems to have lost a lot of its initial selling power. All the promises of freedom now are revealed as, you know, a cruel joke. There's almost no positive content to it at all, the way there was, especially during the, you know, its peak in the late 90s during the Bill Clinton era. Is this some sort of crisis of this order and we just like can't figure out what's coming next?
The neoliberal order was so successful in shutting down alternatives that I think there was frankly a lot of brain drain. People so dominated by groupthink that they could not think of how to respond to this kind of unprecedented situation. And yes, I think that that has led to a kind of delegitimation of the order. But as you point out, they still have enough of a stranglehold on power and mainstream discourse that people just can't seem to find space to think of an alternative quite yet.
And now, since, you know, given the structure of a radio interview, you're the subject presumed to know. Is there a way out, at least the outlines or shadows of a way out?
In the book, I kind of conclude on a note that we need to start thinking in terms of collective agency. Neoliberalism blames the mass of people, the people at large, for the way things are. But the thing is, the people at large are not organized. They are not able to deliberate. They're not able to make conscious choices. And I almost want to think in how could we become the type of collective subject that could be to blame for the situation, that could take responsibility for this situation. But at the same time, the language of blame and judgment and responsibility has been so weaponized by neoliberalism that it's hard not to get caught up in like who is really to blame for the situation, as though that's going to provide the ultimate answer. So, I mean, it's very difficult, but I think that greater practice and experience and experimentation with forms of collective agency is probably literally our only way forward.
That was Adam Kotzka, author of Neoliberalism's Demons on the Political Theology of Late Capital, published in September by Stanford University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the song I played before, but this time a different part, We're All Bourgeois Now, by the 1980s Marxist indie pop band McCarthy. Now, women, sex, and socialism. This is a return appearance by Kristen Godsey to discuss her new book, Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism, and Other Arguments for Economic Independence, just out from Nation Books. Godsey, who teaches anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania, has done extensive work in post-communist societies. Her new book shows that the former communist countries had a lot to offer women, that the competitive individualism of capitalism does a lot of damage to our personal lives, and the possibilities of economic security and equality offered by socialism can repair that damage. Kristen Gobsey. I know your title is meant to catch attention and maybe move some units, but I think there are some like really serious political types who would say that quality of sex is not a prime political concern. It would be nice, but, you know, there are much more important things in life. Just how important is having good sex in when we think of the good life?
Of course, the title doesn't really fully capture what I'm trying to do in the book. There are indeed two chapters about sex, but the rest of the book is much more about women's rights. And we talk about motherhood. I talk about work. I talk about leadership, and sex is just one part of a much broader constellation of factors that I think impact the quality of life. And yes, the title is definitely clickbaity. I admit that. I understand that some very serious political types will be turned off by it. But I actually think in some ways the title captures something that I am trying to do in the book, and that is the way that capitalism commodifies everyday intimacy. And this doesn't necessarily have to be just sex. This could be our friend relationships. This could be our relationships with our parents and our children. What I mean by this is that rather than just commodifying labor, that capital is really commodifying affect. We have these affective resources. And increasingly, we're beginning to think of our emotions and our attentions and our affections as things that get invested and for which we expect some kind of return. It's lent itself to this epidemic of loneliness. And, you know, the last week, there was a big report that was done a couple months ago by Cigna, I believe, about how pervasive loneliness is in the United States. And then just a couple days ago in the New York Times, there was a review of Ben Sasse's book about loneliness and how loneliness is tearing America apart because people who are lonely and isolated are turning to angry forms of politics. So I don't want to make some kind of causal claim that if people were in better relationships, and that includes having better sex, that we would have a much more happy, much less angry, far less polarized society. But I do think that there is a part of the problem that we're facing right now at this particular historical moment that has to do with alienation. And it's not just alienation from our labor in the sort of classical sense, it's alienation from our emotions, alienation from our affective resources. And so, to answer your question directly, no. Given all of the important things that we have to do as a society and what politicians have to think about on a day-to-day basis, you know, having good sex is not the most important thing. But we do know from all sorts of empirical and psychological research that people's emotional states are tied to their relationships. And now that increasingly people are seeing relationships as commodities, that is actually damaging severely the fabric of our society. And so in that respect, I think that paying attention to our intimate relationships and the value of our emotions and our care work is essential if we want to have a happier and more cohesive and less polarized, nasty society.
Yeah, there's plenty to be angry about, so I'm not sure I want to launch a war on anger directly.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be angry. There's definitely a role for anger. Some of the anger is not just born out of the circumstances of the political, you know, situation that we find ourselves in externally. It's also a sort of internal frustration with the fact that people aren't connecting to each other in the same way. In my research in Eastern Europe, one of the things, and I just recently finished a big review of the ethnographic literature that's been published between 1998 and 2018 on really existing lives and people living in post-socialism. And one of the things that comes up again and again and again in discussions of how things were different before 1989 or 1991, depending on where you are, is that there was a certain quality of sociality. People had more time. People were more relaxed. People did not, to the same extent, commodify their personal relationships. And there's a great deal of a longing for that sort of sociality. And so, again, as I say, I make very clear in the book, I'm not talking about returning to 20th century state socialism so that we can have a bunch of great sex. I'm talking about discussing what it was about a less capitalistic society that improved the quality of human relationships.
I think I might have quoted this to you before when we spoke in the past, but a friend of mine from college spent a year living in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, and she said what really struck her and what she missed most about that time was the intensity of friendships, that since there was not a whole lot of, you know, commercial entertainment available, people would hang out with each other in their apartments and drink a lot, but also just talk and have very intense personal relationships. That, of course, has been busted apart.
Exactly. I mean, you hear this over and over again, and you see this when you read the literature. Even survey literature, you know, there have been mass public opinion surveys, and people talk a lot about the decline in public trust, lack of faith in the future. It's definitely worth pointing out here that on the one hand, these were economies of shortage. So, yeah, there was a lot less to do. It's not like you could go shopping at the mall. And, you know, on the other hand, we're also talking about, you know, more than 30 years ago. So there's no internet. There are no iPhones. There are no like fun little apps to keep you distracted. And in fact, this study that I was telling you about loneliness in America, where they surveyed over 20,000 Americans, the interesting thing about that study is that you would assume that the loneliest people in the United States are actually people that are elderly. But it turns out that it's Generation Z. It's people who are between 18 and 22 who report the highest feelings of loneliness. So this brings us back to Mark Fisher's concept of capitalist realism. And I think that Mark Fisher, I'm heavily influenced in many ways by that little book. What he posits is that the sort of epidemic of mental health issues that we have in the developed world is a direct result of our capitalist economy. I heard so many stories about people who either grew up under communism or spent time behind the Iron Curtain prior to 1989. And that's exactly, they all say the same thing. There was this intensity of friendships. Relationships were imbued with an incredible sense of value that did not necessarily have a sort of dollar or ruble equivalent necessarily, right? There's a difference between sort of what we call use value and exchange value. And I think that relationships really stayed within the realm of use value. They weren't a commodity. I think that's really an interesting thing to think about, the extent to which that particular part of the world can tell us something about how our world today is shaped by a particular configuration of political and economic systems that is really alienating us from our own emotions, our own affections, and our own attentions.
Let's talk directly about sex. So the Bolsheviks, the early Bolsheviks, took this sort of thing very seriously, the realm of intimate human relations. And Kollontai, of course, was given a portfolio for this initially. This all crashed in what Ernest Mandel once called the petty bourgeois morality of Stalin.
Right.
In the first 5-10 years, this was something that was central to the Bolshevik agenda. So, you know, we're not talking about trivialities.
No, definitely not. And actually, if we go back and we look very closely at the period between 1917 and 1936, when Stalin finally reverses the two family codes that appear, the first family code appears in 1918, the second family code appears in 1926. Both of these are incredibly radical documents, thinking about redefining marriage and liberating women's sexuality and men's sexuality as well in the context of redesigning a society where marriage and love would not be hindered in any way or hampered by economic considerations. So people like August Bebel were writing about this kind of stuff in the late 19th century. Engels himself talks a little bit about the ways that sexuality and women have been commodified within the bourgeois, quote unquote, monogamous family. And Kollontai, when she becomes the commissar of social welfare, she really gets a portfolio and she lives, you know, she really implements a plan that is going to realize Engels and Bebel's most radical visions for the future. And so she abolishes church marriage. She liberalizes divorce. She gives men and women equality. She eventually, in 1920, she liberalizes a first trimester abortion. There are all sorts of policies that are put in place to try to organize women's labor, to increase the participation of women in the labor force. And in order to do that, Kollontai also tries to convince the Bolshevik leadership to spend an incredible amount of money to create children's homes and mending cooperatives and public canteens and cafeterias, as well as public laundries. And all of these things would socialize housework, which would then, again, allow women to be liberated from the home. Once they were liberated and they had their own wages, they would not be economically dependent on men. And then, in Kollontai's grand vision, they would be able to love out of pure affection and not have to trade their sexuality for rent or food or, some kind of like permanent security in the institution of marriage. Stalin did reverse all of this. But in reality, Soviet Russia in the 20s was not ready for the kind of radical vision that Kollontai had in mind. There were all sorts of problems with homeless children. Men were abandoning women willy-nilly and leaving them and with babies and, you know, without any really reliable form of birth control. There were a lot of unwanted pregnancies, which then exacerbated the problem with the homeless children population. So things were deteriorating into chaos before Stalin reversed everything and went back to a very conservative nuclear family model in the Soviet Union. But I think that what's really important is that a lot of people don't realize what an incredible sex radical Kollontai was. In her 1926 autobiography, it was called The Autobiography of a Sexually Emancipated Communist Woman. She was really, really quite out there in her own personal relationships. She had a couple of, you know, tempestuous affairs with younger men. And if you go back and you read, there are a couple of wonderful biographies of her. If you read about her life, she certainly seems like she's out of 2018 rather than 1917. So I do think that it's important to keep in mind that this long-standing critique that capitalism commodifies intimate relations goes way, way back to the 19th century. In some ways, I'm not saying anything new at all. I'm just sort of reminding people that there's this whole over 130-year critique out there about the relationship between capitalism and sexuality.
You say several times, I believe, in the book that Soviet sex sucked.
Just to clarify that, I think that that's because, you know, abortion was illegal for quite a while in the Soviet Union, and then after Stalin's death, it was liberalized, but it was never under the greatest conditions. Birth control wasn't always widely available, and there was really no good public sex education. So when we compare the Soviet Union to what was going on in places like East Germany or Poland or Czechoslovakia or Yugoslavia, the Soviet Union and Romania and Albania really kind of comparatively were not so great. And that's why I wanted to make clear in the book that there was variety across the block. I'm not making a homogenous claim.
I'm speaking with Kristen Godsey, author of Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism. The most fascinating contrast is East Germany and West. There's a fair amount of data on that. You know, it's almost like a natural experiment. These are two countries that had common origin, then were split apart, so they then developed in different ways with different economic and social systems. What can you say about the contrasting sexual experiences, particularly for women, in the two Germanies?
So this is amazing stuff, because from a very early period in the 80s, there were these German sexologists, Kurt Stark being the key one, who started actually asking people about sexual satisfaction. Now, of course, this is self-reported data, and there are always issues with self-reported data, but they're asking East and West German women. It does turn out that there is something interesting going on, and we have wonderful data there on this, because historians Dagmar Herzog, Paul Betts have written extensively, a woman named Ingrid Sharp, who's a German cultural historian, and then there's an entire book by Josie McClellan called Love in the Time of Communism, and all of these different studies point to the fact that sexuality in the East was perceived to be freer, less encumbered by economic considerations, less commodified, you know, less commercialized. And so therefore, people experienced it as better. And one of the things that Herzog finds is that in her research in both Eastern and Western Germany after 89 is consistently people from the East report that one of the saddest things, one of the greatest losses that they feel was both gay and straight alike, interestingly as well, was that there was this different, more natural, less commercialized form of sexuality that existed in the East that no longer exists in reunified Germany because sort of Western cultural mores have taken over. So I do think the big thing that Herzog argues in, she has this wonderful book called Sex After Fascism, and she makes this claim that because East German women were truly economically independent, in the sense that they had not only their own jobs, but they also had access to these public services like childcare, public cafeterias, and also a society in which it was really okay to be a single mom, German women had an incredible amount of self-confidence in choosing their sexual partners, and they never had to choose a partner based on money considerations or economic considerations. When women are able to take care of themselves, you know, men apparently sort of have to behave a little bit better. And that means that they also have to be a little bit more generous in the bedroom than they otherwise might be, because women can leave. That's the key, that women's economic independence leads to a certain kind of self-confidence, not only in life, and as you know, as I talk about in the book, there's work and motherhood, but also in the intimate sphere.
And some men that you quote were celebrating the end of communism because it made women more dependent on them.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, a lot of East German men basically admitted that they have much more power over women in the West now that money can buy you access to sexuality. Yeah, I think the direct quote is that, like, the difference between a doctor's salary and the salary of a theater director would not make a difference in your ability to get a woman, right? Because women weren't basically choosing you because of your financial resources. And so, yeah, a lot of men reported that it was kind of a liberation to be able to sort of reclaim a quote unquote natural masculine identity of breadwinner, and that having access to financial resources could basically buy you access to sexuality. And that's the other thing I talk about in the book, is sexual economics theory, which is essentially a couple of American social psychologists making this exact argument that that's how sex works. And what they don't realize, and what I find so interesting, was that without knowing it, these social psychologists basically wrote a paper validating 150 years of socialist theory on sexuality under capitalism, which is pretty funny.
And it wasn't just East Germany. I was surprised to see that Poland, with its socially conservative Catholic history, women reported much freer sex even in that country.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Poland is really the interesting case here because, as you say, it really was. It is a very conservative Catholic country, but they had very good sex education. They had, I have a colleague who was just here giving a talk about the, you know, sex ed manuals for children. There was a very popular manual called The Art of Loving, which I think sold 7 million copies or something like that, which was a Polish sort of sex, you know, how-to kind of guide. They had sex education schools, they had access to birth control, but and they had access to abortion, something that they don't have anymore post-89. And, you know, and I think that it's not just Poland. Again, you know, I have another colleague who's just written a book called Sexual Liberation Socialist Style about Czechoslovakia. I just wrote a column, as I think I shared with you in the Washington Post, about this book that was translated into Bulgarian, again, which was sort of a sex guide or a guide, guide to intimate relations between men and women. And Yugoslavia was incredibly liberal. So I do think there was an incredible amount of diversity around the bloc. We've heard most about Germany because, as you pointed out, it was a natural experiment. And the only thing that really separated them was 40 years of capitalism versus communism. And so the fact that in that short of a period of time, people began to relate to each other differently, I think it really gives us food for thought to really think about how capitalism impacts our personal relationships.
And in a less extreme contrast, if you look at the Nordic social democracies, which are capitalist but a much softened version of capitalism, do we see some version of the effect that you saw in the communist countries there?
Definitely. I mean, women, you know, have far more freedom in places like Sweden and Norway and Finland, Iceland. I mean, I think Iceland is universally regarded as sort of the best place in the world to be a woman, which also means, you know, more satisfying personal relationships. And these countries vary on the scale of, you know, social democracy versus democratic socialism, because, like, in Norway, I think one out of every three employees is a state employee, and the Norwegian government actually controls quite a bit of the Norwegian economy. But yes, as you're right, Sweden is really just fundamentally a market economy with a really large social safety net. But the Swedes have been really progressive about expanding childcare and making sure that the parental leave policies, which are very generous, are shared by both men and women, but both fathers and mothers take parental leave. There's a way in which you can take these policies and implement them. You know, it doesn't have to be a state run command economy in order for you to have a greater level of women's rights. It's important to go back and to see that there were these real gains that were made, you know, despite many, many other problems, there were these policies that we could learn from. And that's what I'm trying to get people to talk about in the context of the book. Look, you and I think, know that a lot of what I'm saying here is really not newsflash. People have been discussing these policies for a really long time. But I think for a generation of younger people who don't know necessarily the history of socialism, or if they do know about socialism, they know really only the economic side, and they don't understand the side that deals with women's emancipation and sexuality and these more kind of softer human emotion sides. And so in some ways, I really want this the book to kind of reach out to people and say, hey, socialism is not just about correcting income inequality, which is obviously a problem, but there are these other things that also were going to be tackled in these very early texts. I mean, Bevel is 1879, and Kollontai is writing in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, all of these essays about sexual relations and the class struggle. And people just don't remember that, or they don't know. They never knew it in the first place, right? I think it would behoove a lot of people to go back and read these early texts and see that, wow, a lot of the things that Kollontai is talking about in some of her short stories are really applicable to our lives today.
Well, I would say this is important because a whole lot of Western socialists and social democrats have not emphasized these issues enough. I mean, people are always talking about, you know, these big macro kinds of questions, income distribution and the organization of production and such, but organization of ownership. But you know, what capitalism does to our friendships, our romances, our sex lives, these really intimate details of daily life is very profound, and it really deserves much more importance, much more attention by people who do politics.
Absolutely, and I do think that part of the reason that, you know, I mean, obviously, as you pointed out earlier, there are these really big structural problems that we're facing, income inequality, these macroeconomic issues about how to organize the economy to prevent these, you know, tragic boom and bust cycles. There's so much that we could be focusing on. But I do think that ordinary people can get alienated. I mean, I'm not using that word ironically, but, you know, they can be put off, let's put it that way, by this sort of larger macroeconomic, economic discussions of policy and, you know, the size of the social welfare state and how much taxation and redistribution, or should there be state ownership of the means of production, and how much should it be social ownership of the means of production? Should it be localized? I mean, there are all these incredibly intense debates on the left. But what gets dropped out, I think, unfortunately, too often, is how capitalism affects our emotions, our friendships, our relationships with our parents, our relationships with our kids. And these are, for most people, this is our daily lives. These are the things that we think about. We think about the people in our lives. Relationships make us happy. They make us sad. They give us support when we need support. We feel alienated when those relationships fall apart. You know, listen to pop music. I mean, pop music is 95% about relationships, right? This is the thing that is the bread and butter of most people's lives. And I do think that when we talk about socialism, when we talk about socialist ideals, when we talk about even just radical political theories more generally, we should be attuned to the fact that people are going to, like, kind of, you know, maybe sit up and pay attention to discussions about their personal lives in a way that's going to be very different than, you know, whether or not there should be trade unions and how big and how organized and across what lines and, you know, identity politics versus solidarity. There are all these other big structural issues, but I do think that intimate relations deserve a place in the discussion. And I'm really hoping that the book and some of the work that's being done by a lot of my wonderful, really smart colleagues doing historical and ethnographic work in Eastern Europe is going to help open up this conversation more broadly to a general public.
But these kinds of concerns with intimate life get marginalized or diminished as girly.
Right. And that's the problem with brocialism, right? It is a little bit a part of the inherent sexism sometimes on the left. And, you know, and Kollontai, by the way, in 1918, 1919, 1920, she faced the exact same accusations. Like, why should we care about people's marriages? We're trying to, like, fight a civil war here, lady. You know, so from the very beginning, these issues of, like, redefining marriage and redefining love do get marginalized as girly because, you know, they're about emotions, and people tend to associate emotionality, and especially people understand quite reasonably that care work, the care for the elderly, the care for the sick, the care for the young, is generally women's work. And so these issues do get pushed to the side as women's issues. But I think, look, from the very beginning, people like Anessa Armand, you know, we're saying if women's liberation is impossible without communism, then communism is impossible without women's liberation. And from the very earliest moments, these two issues were linked. And people who are coming back to these socialist ideas today need to remember that this was always part of the program. This is not an invention of the 70s, which is what a lot of people think, that this is like some kind of accretion from socialist feminists working in the 70s. No, it goes all the way back to the earliest stages, right? Lily Brown, you know, in the middle of the 19th century was talking about maternity insurance and the role of the state in taking care of children and children as a social good. Yes, I'm very aware that people are going to consider this a girly issue. And it's true that I addressed my book primarily to younger women. But I don't think it should be a girly issue. I think it should, men should pay attention to, because let's face it, right? Men are the beneficiaries of a lot of emotional labor from women. And if women are happier emotionally, and certainly if women are happier in the bedroom, men are going to be happier too. This is sort of a win-win situation.
But the men might have to be more interesting.
They will have to be more interesting, yes. They can't just, you know, hope to have a shiny car and a nice, you know, new phone.
That was Kristen Gotze, author of Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism and Other Arguments for Economic Independence, just out from Nation Books. Gotze teaches anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, again a different part of a song I played before. This, the Communist Love Song by the 90s indie pop band Sleepyhead. Till next week, bye.